the words that we're singing. Anyway, we're turning back now to the book of Judges, and we're looking at the life of Samson, aren't we, which is covered over a good few chapters. So there's a few weeks left for us looking at Samson. We remember some of the events of the angel declaring to us of his birth and what kind of upbringing he must have, and the beginning of him finding and wanting for himself a Philistine wife, and that going backwards and forwards, a few visits down there, demanding a pagan wife, the lion in the vineyard that provides the material for a riddle as he kills the lion and then goes back later to look at it, and there is a swarm of bees that have produced honey within it. The men then, they blackmail and threaten, don't they, his wife during the week-long wedding feast, that if she doesn't tell them the riddle, that they're going to burn down her with her father's house. And she finally caves in, betrays Samson, doesn't she? But then 30 men are dead and stripped to pay off the bet that Samson had with these men. Samson returns now back to Zorah, absolutely enraged at the sense of being betrayed and losing the bet. And the wife is then given by the father to the companion. Well, it seems all quiet in Philistia, doesn't it? The father has given the wife of Samson to his best man there, and life has seemed to have calmed down after the massacre of the 30 men and the bet and all of that. Just everything seems to be pretty quiet there, doesn't it, in Timnah. But then Samson returns. We turn to chapter 15. After a while, everything seemed to have settled down. It's nice and peace and quietful. It's the time of harvest and everything. The sun is shining. You've got to try and put yourself in the situation and the scenario. All of those details are there for us so that we can try to imagine what is going on. It's the time of the wheat harvest. It happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. It's a quiet day in May, we're told, is when the wheat harvest is at that part of the world. And all seems to be nice and quiet on a nice sunny May afternoon. There's a knock at the door, isn't there? And Samson is there with a young goat rather than a bunch of flowers. In our scenario and situation, a bunch of flowers would have done the job, but a young goat so that everybody could have a real nice feast. Well, that says a lot more than a bunch of flowers in that part of the world at the time. He has a twinkle in his eye, and he is willing to forgive and to forget if he can just take her back to be his wife. You can imagine the father's predicament at this point. He says, I thought that you utterly, absolutely, and completely despised us for giving in to this blackmail and telling the men this riddle. What could I do but give her to your best man? Surely her younger sister will do. I can imagine that he's probably somewhat perplexed, thinking these Hebrews, completely different culture, isn't it? Completely different way of living. He's probably scratching his head going, these Hebrews, they're a right funny bunch, aren't they? But I would imagine not only is he slightly perplexed at the way that Hebrews do things and at Samson's behavior, but he's somewhat scared as well. Samson had killed 30 men, hadn't he? And I'm sure that they had heard and known all about that. Well, now Samson is even more furious by the rejection. And he says, doesn't he, I will be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them. He doesn't know exactly what he's going to do at that point, but he is enraged and he's going to do something. And someone is more than likely going to get hurt. It was all quiet at the end of chapter 14, but as soon as you open chapter 15, you could say a whole can of worms has been opened up, but more than likely in the situation, you'd say a can of foxes rather than a can of worms has been opened up. And what does he do? He goes and grabs all these foxes, he ties their tails together, he puts a torch between them, and he lights it, and he just sets them off into the field. Well, by this time, I don't know how you would put it in your vernacular, in your language, in my generation, we would say he's a one-man wrecking crew. I don't know what you guys would say. That's what we used to say when we were teenagers. If somebody was really on a blast and leaving a trail of destruction behind them, we'd say this is a one-man wrecking crew. You could say, I don't know, if you're a little older maybe, well, he just wreaks havoc wherever he goes. I know that that's what my mother's generation would say. Whatever it is, wherever he goes, there is trouble. Wherever the Philistines are resolving their problems, Samson seems to be the solution dissolver. Again and again throughout these passages, sometimes we look so clearly at one little part, don't we, that we don't see the big picture. But as we look at the big picture, maybe just for a few moments or two, we see that there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of little problems. And the Philistines have a problem. They seem to resolve the problem. But then Samson comes in and everything goes up in smoke, so to speak. They answer the riddle, don't they, by threats. But then there's a slaughter of 30 men in Ashkelon. They think they have solved the problem and they have a solution for their problem, but in jumps Samson and now 30 men are dead. Samson is gone, peace is restored, the wife is given to the best man. Solved the problem, haven't we? Samson comes back and there are flaming foxes and they lose everything. They threaten to burn up the Temanite's wife and the father. Well, they get away with that in getting the truth out of her, but then there is a great slaughter, isn't there? Samson is bound and betrayed and handed over by his own people. They think they've solved the problem at this point, but then he breaks free, takes hold of a jawbone, and there is another massacre. In chapter 16, it goes on. They ambush, by this point, I hope this isn't irreverent, but he has become somewhat of a gigolo or a playboy in our vernacular maybe. But they think that they've got him and they've bound him and they've ambushed him. And what does he do? He smashes down the gates and he carries them 7 miles and throws them over the hillside. Finally, they get to the bottom. They solve the riddle. Why is this man so strong? And why is it that he just smashes every single solution to our problems? Well, it's his hair, isn't it? They get to the bottom of that. They shave off his hair. But they don't continue to do so. It grows back and he ends up pulling the temple down upon, well, many hundreds of people. There are 7 bowstrings at one point that bind him. There are new ropes. There is a loom. There is the razor. There are all of these solutions to their problems. But Samson just keeps ruining everything for them. There's a solution and then Samson brings failure. There is success, Samson brings disaster. There is victory, but then Samson brings defeat again and again and again. And that leads us into our first point maybe this evening, which we have to say, in my mind, is the humor of Yahweh. There is wit, there is comedy, there is entertainment and jesting and amusement, mockery, sarcasm and cynicism in this narrative of Samson's life. Now obviously we must be very careful when we apply all of these things to God and to his work, but there is biting satire, there is spoof if you like, and ridicule here against the Philistines. Do these things exist within the mind and the will and the vocabulary of Almighty God? I think we would have to say, in light of this narrative, that they do. We read, didn't we, in Luke chapter 10, that Jesus rejoiced. He just really rejoiced. Yes, it was in a spiritual thing that these seeming babes, it wasn't the priests, it wasn't the intellectual elite that were being converted, but there was plenty of people from a lower middle class or a working class background who were hearing the gospel and going, yeah, that is true, and they were believing in the Saviour. And Christ is just rejoicing, isn't he? Rejoicing in his spirit. We could have read from the book of Hebrews in chapter 12, couldn't we? That for the joy that is set before him, he endures the cross. So certainly Jesus was a man that rejoiced and had great joy even at the prospect of the cross. But when you read between the lines and you read the Sermon on the Mount and other things, when Jesus talks about trying to take the speck out of somebody else's eye while you've got a log in your own eye, that's just highly funny, to be quite honest and frank. Or when he talks about the Pharisees as blind guides leading the blind down into a ditch, I'm sure that there would be more than a smile or a smirk, probably even audible laughter by a number of people in the crowds. We look at the irony, the satire and the ridicule that there is. They win a bet, but they lose 30 men as a response. They gain peace, but then they lose all of the harvest, the vineyards and the olive groves. Admittedly, this wouldn't have been funny for some kind of environmental group that were for Save the Foxes or whatever they might have been. It wasn't funny for the foxes. But when you were reading this, as an Israelite, you would find this, well, more than slightly humorous. The wife and the father, they save themselves, don't they, by getting the riddle out of Samson and telling the men, only to be burned by exactly the same men a little while later. They bind Samson, but then he kills 1,000 men with a jawbone. It's there for us that we not just smile or smirk, but even as you're reading these accounts, I think they're there for us that many people, particularly the Israelites, would have read these things and they would break out in laughter. We too need to smile a little at the narrative. It is subtle, yet very, very powerful irony. Really, God is crying out through the passage, just have a look at the stupidity of the Philistines. Does God do things like this? I think Psalm 2 would just solve the whole case. In the book of Galatians, it says, God is not mocked. That which we sow, we shall reap. God will not be mocked. God will not be derided. God will not be the butt of our jokes and the last laugh, so to speak. But Psalm 2 tells us that if we set ourselves against God, if we will not trust him, if we will not serve him, if we will not believe in him, if we rebel against him, well, does not the psalmist say that the Lord laughs and he will hold them in derision? God does laugh. God does have somewhat of a sense of humour. Now, we need to be very careful. We need to be very reverent, obviously, when we're thinking like this. But surely the point and the purpose of us keep coming back here week in and week out, year in and year out, Sunday by Sunday, Tuesday by Tuesday, the whole point of us having a Bible in our own language and study Bibles and everything else is so that we can really grasp the nature and the being and the person of God. Now, God is holy, God is righteous, God is just, God is eternal, God is unchanging, God is omnipotent, and all of those other attributes and everything. And we would grapple with them, and we do grapple with them at various different times. But as we read this passage, and I really look at the passage, I think it reminds us that God does have something of a sense of humour. And I don't think that it's irreverent, unbiblical heresy to say so. If we are created in the image of God and we naturally express humour, we love to smile, we love to laugh, as long as the joke is pure and wholesome and can be said in public. We love a bit of satire and irony, justice and sarcasm. We love a story that entertains us. We always have as human beings and we always will. Well, if we're created and made in the image of God, then surely God has this attribute and these ways as well. Now, we must be careful because I see evil and sin in the world that I live in, but there is no evil or sin in God. So it's not like I look at the world that I live in and that is a perfect reflection of what God is like. No, it is not a perfect reflection of what God is like. Heaven and the Garden of Eden before there was sin was a perfect reflection of who God was and is. This, in this time and in this age with sin and evil and death and suffering, is not a perfect reflection of who God is. But I see irony and sarcasm and humour and entertainment and all of these kinds of things. And when I see the suffering of unjust people, I enjoy it. They've got what they deserve. They got what's coming to them. Yeah, God won't be mocked, will he? What you sow, that you shall reap. You see, God is like that, isn't he? And it just reminds me, as I try to grapple with the mind and the heart and the being of God, as I get past the elementary things that we learn in Sunday school, the building blocks, if you like, of the being and the nature of God, and really try to press on and really try to push into who is God and what is he like, I realize as I read passages like this that God does have a sense of humor. And that God, although he is not a person, he has personality. And the reason I am like I am and you are like you are is because we are made and created in the image of God. And we are created firstly and foremost above everything else, not to get rich, not to entertain ourselves, not to have a good time, not to do this, that and the other, become famous or have a good reputation or any of those things. We are created first and foremost above everything else to know God and to enjoy him. That is what we are primarily created for. That's why the Puritans, the first question in the catechism, what is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy him. And to really enjoy something or someone, we really need to get to know them. And these kinds of passages, when I read between the lines, I kind of see God in the background somewhat mocking his enemies, somewhat laughing at them, saying, have a look at the irony of all of this. And when I see God in this way, not as a person but with personality, it reminds me that God is not distant and that God is not removed and God is not incapable of relating or communicating with us, but in actual fact, he has become a man. And he is, although he is infinitely transcendent, God has become a man, and in becoming a man, the writer of the book of Hebrews says with a double negative that we do not have a high priest that cannot sympathize with our weaknesses and our failures, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. See, I read this passage, and you can go through it maybe, and you cannot scratch beneath the surface, and you can go, okay, there's a whole lot of people that are dying here, there's enemies, and there's fighting, and there's this, that, and the other. But when you read the literature, and you read it in its context and everything, I can see irony, I can see sarcasm, I can see God mocking his enemies, I can see God saying, just have a good look at them. Though they are ruling over you, they are, well, just plain stupid. It reminds us of the humor of Yahweh and that he is not a person, but he has personality. And many of the things that we see in ourselves and amongst ourselves as human beings, these are a direct reflection of what God is like and that God is near and that God is close. And I can talk with God. And I can get to know the living God, and I can experience God, and I can cry out to God, and that the main purpose of my and your existence is to grow in a deep, 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 meaningful relationship with him. Didn't we just sing my best and only friend? Well, it's not that we don't have any friends at all and we're a right sour bunch that can't make any friends. You may have many friends and some very good friends at that. But our relationship with God and our intimacy and our closeness with God, as we realize that God knows more about us than anybody else ever could, and he knows more about us than I could ever know about myself, he is my best and in some sense my only real true friend. Because if we knew one another as God knows us, or we knew one another as we know ourselves, we wouldn't really want to be friends with one another. But here is God, and here he is in this passage, and it seeps out to me through the passage that here is a God who does have a sense of humor. Here is a God who does use irony. Here is a God who is sarcastic sometimes. Here is a God who does mock his enemies on occasion. And the lesson is
The lesson is for us who believe that we need to draw near to him as our best and our only friend. And the lesson to any unbeliever here this evening is the peril of being an enemy of Yahweh. You will look stupid. You will end up looking stupid. Maybe not in this life. You might die in this life really rich and really famous and really old and all of those other things, and everybody at your funeral is giving you a huge applause for a wonderful life. But if you make yourself an enemy of God by not trusting in his son Jesus Christ, by not living and serving him with your life, you will end up looking stupid on the day of judgment. It's just that clear and plain. And what he is doing here, it's not that God delights to do these things whatsoever, but these Philistines have pitted themselves against God, and they have made God, the living God, their enemy because they have subjected his people. And so God is mocking them. God is, with a sense of humor, if you like, toying and playing with them, making them look stupid, as he will do to everyone that will not trust, believe, follow, obey, and serve him. Well, as we scratch beneath the surface, I can certainly see the humor of Yahweh. That though he is not a person, and we're not dragging God down to our limited personality or such, but God does have a personality. And as we read between these lines, I think that we can see more of who God is and really what God is like. Certainly Psalm 2 says that he will laugh as he mocks his enemies at the end of time. Well, second point then for us this evening. We've seen the humor of Yahweh that's there beneath the surface, I think, but seen quite clearly, hopefully, as it's been brought out in that way. The second thing we see much clearer this evening is the lethargy of Judah. Let's look at them then. Because the Philistines, after the foxes have burnt down everything, you see, they thought they had peace in dealing with Samson in the way that his, but he comes back, this one man wrecking crew, and he gathers the foxes together, and they end up just losing everything, don't we? And ironically, the wife and the father who had escaped being burnt by these men is killed by them. Well, Samson leaves, and he goes down back, doesn't he, to the cleft of the rock, and they're all asking who's done this, and they find out where he is, so they march down there into the land of Judah, and they start demanding, where on earth is this Samson? We're going to give to him what he really justly deserves. So although there is irony and there is humor within the narrative, there is also tragedy. The prank with the foxes led to another fire, didn't it? The threat at the wedding was avoided, but it was only temporarily avoided. Samson wanted revenge. He gets it. But now the men of Judah, what about them? They are not in a right state and condition, are they? And so our second point is the lethargy of the men of Judah. The Philistines, they come down threatening, and they're asking, why on earth have you come down here? What have you come down here for? 3,000 of the men then go down to Samson, and you see it in verse 11, the very tragic and sad, sad words. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock at Etam, and they said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? That's very sad, sad, pitiful words, isn't it, really? They've just acquiesced. They've just submitted to it, haven't they? They're not even that bothered by it, if you like. They can't imagine anything beyond the status quo. They see a judge who is obviously raised up by God, who is doing mighty things that is really thwarting and making the Philistines look absolutely ridiculous and stupid. But they see a judge and a deliverance as a threat to peace, stability, and order. They look upon Yahweh's enemies as their rightful lords, and they can quickly forsake the Lord, but they're not quick to forsake the Philistine rule over them. They see Samson as fighting against them and not against the Philistines. You see it there, don't we, in verse 11? Don't you know that they rule over us? What is this that you have done to us? Now, they should have gone to Samson and they said, right, the Philistines are here, you're the judge, you're the deliverer, we are behind you, we'll follow you, whatever needs to be done, it will be done, and we will be set free again so that we can live the way that God wants us to live. But that's not how they act and speak, is it? Don't you know that the Philistines are the lords over us? What is this that you have done to us? No, 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 what Samson has been doing has been to the Philistines. But now they can't see it, can they? And they see Samson as fighting against them rather than the Philistines. What is this you have done to us? Your impertinent outbursts have endangered our safety, our peace, and our way of life. In today's culture, you'd have somebody, maybe from Judea, a spokesman, standing up on national and international news, reading out a statement something like this. How outraged we are at Samson's irresponsible, inexcusable, and unauthorized behavior. We in no way condone but condemn him as a renegade, a rebel, an insurgent, a revolutionary, a splinter group who misrepresents our international policies. Come and take him. We will extradite him. Do with you as you want. Do with him as you want. And we can all live at peace again. This is a terrible thing for the men of Judah to have fallen into. Samson seems to be nonchalant and blasé about the whole thing. He's indifferent that they're willing to betray even one of their own men. Well, I only gave him what's fair. We're even Stevens. But if you want to bind me, well, bind me, hand them over, hand me over to them, but just make sure you don't kill me. They say, no problem. We won't kill you. We'll just bind you and hand you over to the people that will kill you. And these men are the men of Judah, who had great military supremacy in times past. You read about them in the book of Judges right at the very beginning, and they're not afraid of anything or anyone. They are trusting in the Lord, they are following him, they are willing to obey him no matter what he asked them to do. But by this point in chapter 15, well, I say it, there we say it, that they are just spineless wimps. By this point, they have no hatred of the enemies of God. They have no difficulty with being enslaved and ruled over by some of the most wicked and pagan heathen people on the face of the earth. It reminds us that Jesus was very, very different. He wouldn't acquiesce and he wouldn't compromise. There was no friendliness or cuddling up to the bosom of evil in him whatsoever. He knew that there was a fight and it was on, wasn't it? And right from the very beginning of the Bible, it tells us, doesn't he, that God was going to put enmity between the serpent and the seed of the woman. And there was enmity every single day of his life. He never acquiesced. He never bowed down. He always resisted. There was always antagonism and conflict and clash and quarrel and variance. He always collided with evil. But now these men are in a very, very different situation and circumstance. We too, though, we too have to realize a world that we are in, and we can't acquiesce. And we can't bow down and we can't quieten down like the world does so very, very often. But we have to stand up with a bit of backbone, don't we? And we need to say that truth is truth and light is light and darkness is darkness and right is right and wrong is wrong, no matter how unpopular it is. Ye that love the Lord, the psalmist says, hate evil. What about Psalm 139? Surely you will slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloodthirsty men, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am I not grieved with those who rise up against thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. You see, here is somebody who won't cuddle up to the evil of the day. He won't acquiesce. He won't compromise. He is colliding head on with any and everything that is against righteousness and truth. Well, we see the very opposite of that in the men of Judah. And that's our second point this evening, isn't it? The lethargy of these men. And we've got to judge ourselves. We've got to ask ourselves, is there a real measure of evangelical zeal? Is there a real passion and a heart for truth and for what is right and for the gospel and for Jesus Christ and for pure worship and the glory of God? The Bible speaks, doesn't it? If we live for the Lord, or if we die, we die for the Lord. Whether therefore we live or die, we are the Lord's. Well, we see the humour of God, something of the nature and the heart of God, if you like, and the mind of God. We see, secondly, the lethargy of the men of Judah. And, well, that's the bad example. And that is a bad example for us to avoid and go in exactly the opposite direction. Third and final point as we close then is the sufficiency of Jehovah. So we see this in verse 14 onwards. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. So here they are with their war cry. Here he is, the loser, betrayed by his own people. You're going to get what's coming to you now, mate. And they're starting to think, aren't they? He's bound, he's betrayed, he's handed over by his own people. There's no getting out of this. We're going to do to him what he rightly deserves, and we're going to do to him what he has done to us. And you can imagine it, can't you, with something of an army of heathen, pagan Philistines. Well, they're shouting, aren't they? And, well, the unbeliever never considers what's going to happen next, because then the Spirit of the Lord comes mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arm become like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reaches out his hand and takes it. He kills 1,000 men with it, and then you have his little pun. The ropes snap, don't they? And he takes hold of a jawbone because the Spirit of the Lord comes down upon him. We have that again and again and again, don't we, in the life of Samson. The unbeliever never takes these things into consideration. He is completely oblivious to the Spirit of God. And so there they are with their war cry, and they think this man is as good as dead. Well, no, he's not, because the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and that twists and changes and turns everything. Then there's the pun, isn't there, after all of the men, the 1,000 men are done. With the jawbone of an ass, I have piled them in a mass. He says it's a play on words that we don't get so much in the English here, but it rhymes and it's just playing around with words. And he's just rejoicing as well, and he's using some kind of irony and sarcasm and playing around with words as well, as the Lord has enabled. Well, after all of that, and it's been a busy day for him after all, he has killed 1,000 men with a jawbone, he cries out to the Lord in verse 18. You've given this great deliverance, he says, by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised. It goes on to describe how the Lord splits the rock and water comes forth and he is revived and refreshed. This is the first time we see Samson crying out to the Lord. So often when Samson gets a very rough and a bad deal because of his many and varied mistakes, we are reminded here that he was a man that did cry out to the Lord, and he does judge Israel for 20 years, we are told. He gives God glory, but he cries out for help, and the rock is split, and he is refreshed. And it just reminds us of the sufficiency of God. This is a place, isn't it, where there has been death, and, well, where there has been death and victory is the place of refreshment. And that's where we go as well, don't we? If we want our souls refreshed, if we want to be satisfied, if we want to be content, if we want to feel whole, if we want to feel fully human as God would intend us to be human, too, filled with the Spirit like Samson was, we need to go back to the place of death and victory to the Lord Jesus Christ. Who did he not stand up and cried out in a loud voice, saying, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me. And if anyone believes in me, as the scriptures have said, from his innermost being shall flow out torrents of living water. You see the sufficiency of God. The God of the Bible is not a God who can just help us out a little bit. He is a God who can help us out a little bit. And he can set our lives right. And he can answer us loads of questions. And he can give us some wisdom. And if you were just to be an unbeliever and live your life according to the book of Proverbs, what a far easier and better life you would have. But that is not what God is here to do. He is here to satisfy the very depths of our entire being, isn't he? And he is sufficient to meet all of our needs so that in whatever situation we might find ourselves, we too can say with Paul, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That is a monumentous statement for a human being to make. I can do all things. That is confidence and faith in a sufficient God, isn't it? A God who can provide for us in any and in every way, in any and every situation, so that we can humbly, but by faith believingly, do all things through him. Does Paul not say, him who did not spare his own son, how will he not with him freely give us all things? And we see here, don't we, in Samson's case, the place where there was death and victory is where refreshing waters come out, and he goes on then to judge Israel for 20 years. There is something of humour in God, isn't there, as we have seen. We've seen the awful example of the lethargy, reminding us that we must be zealous and fervent in our walk with God. And we've also seen the sufficiency of God for all of our needs. Well, I'm sure that there must be something there for each and every one of us. If not, maybe you need to pray when you come back next week, God, give me ears to hear what you would have to say to me when I come into this place. Well, we're going to close. We're going to sing 112, thinking about our last